And in order to get a good starting handle on where these are, I just think we need to take a couple of minutes and refresh our minds on the return from the exile. And for your own reading and study, you're going to find that the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah are excellent backups to this. You remember I told you earlier that if you begin reading in the 14th chapter of 2 Kings and read through the rest of 2 Kings, Ezra, and Nehemiah, you will have the historical background for the minor prophets. Well, the last 11 chapters of 2 Kings have taken care of the first 9 minor prophets from a historical setting. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah give us the historical setting for the last 3, because Ezra and Nehemiah were both involved in the return. I mentioned to you that there were 3 waves of captivity. In other words, when Babylon came into Judea, and ultimately to Jerusalem, they came 3 different times. And we normally think of the waves of captivity, the first wave happening in about 606. Some people lean towards 605. I'm not going to be contentious about that. But that was when the first wave of Jews were taken into captivity, and probably the group that Daniel was in. And then in 598, 597, we have a second wave going. And then in 588, there was another besieging, and ultimately in 586, the temple was destroyed. And that led to the third wave. The only reason I put that up is that when they returned from the exile, they also came in 3 waves. And the return waves came in about 536 B.C. when Zerubbabel brought the largest contingency back from Babylon, and he brought about 50,000 people with him. The second contingency was smaller, and it was a return of about 2,000 that came with Ezra in about 458. And then in about 445, around there, Nehemiah brings the third wave back, and they are the smallest of the 3. So there was slightly over 50,000 people that actually came back. And as I said last night, that's a far cry from the number that went. But when they came back, one of their tasks was to rebuild the temple that had been destroyed, because this was the house of the Lord. And we're going to see, particularly in Haggai and Zechariah, the gist of those books, to a large extent, not totally, but to a large extent, is to encourage the people to rebuild the temple. And I don't have time, and it wouldn't be necessarily prudent tonight to go through the book of Ezra in detail, but just to refresh your memory, this first wave came back and began rebuilding the temple. And they got discouraged, and they had things that discouraged them. And to make a long story short, they started, but they didn't get very far. So in about 520 B.C., that's when we find Haggai and Zechariah, the books being written, the people needed to be encouraged and exhorted to get back with their building program, if you will. And the temple was ultimately completed in 516 B.C. So you can see they were back for 20 years, and it sure didn't take 20 years to rebuild the temple had they been diligent about it. And when we go to the book of Haggai, we're going to see him chastising them for their lack of diligence. I'm just going to comment also that there are all different ways of, there are 2 different ways that people will count the 70-year captivity. One of them is to take it from 606 to 536, and that is 70 years. And the other one is to take it from 586, when the temple was destroyed, to 516, when the temple was finally completed. And that will also give you 70 years. Exactly which God meant when he said you will have 70 years of captivity, I don't know that we can know for sure. My personal opinion is it had to do with the time from the temple's destruction to the temple being rebuilt. Okay, now the temple that was rebuilt in 516 was sometimes kind of referred to as Zerubbabel's temple. Now later on, Herod kind of remodeled and refurbished it. But it was actually the basic structure that you found in place when Jesus went into the temple. Although, as I understand it, there was still some refurbishing and remodeling going on even during Jesus' time. Now, that's going to be important when we look at a couple of passages tonight, so I wanted to lay that groundwork before us. But with all of this in place, we've got the background for the books of Haggai and Zechariah. Okay, are there any questions on that or the return from the exile? And you remember that Cyrus was the king of Persia who allowed the Jews to come back. Now, he wasn't turning the Jews free, because Israel was still a province of Persia. He was simply saying you can move from this province to that province, and that was a good thing. But now Cyrus is dead, and he has a replacement. In fact, there's been two replacements since Cyrus when we find Haggai. Okay, any comments or questions on that general introduction before we begin on the book of Haggai in specifics? I didn't mention, if you haven't been here and don't have copies of these charts, feel free to raise your hand and we'll make sure you get one. And if you don't have a Bible, this would sure be a good night to have one. Okay? The book of Haggai, and I'll be looking at the first verse, starts in the second year of Darius the king. Now, this is not the same Darius that you find in the book of Daniel. If you look on that chart, the hard-to-read chart or the easier-to-read chart, you're going to see that this is Darius Histopus, I guess is the way I would say it. I don't know how to say these names, and if I ever find anyone that knows how to say them, I'm going to drill him good, I guess, until he can tell me. But this is Darius Histopus, who replaced Cambius, who replaced Cyrus. So we're two leaders now removed from the famous Cyrus. But Haggai really leaves nothing to be questioned about when he wrote, because you're going to see that he wrote in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month. So we're the sixth month, by their reckoning, gets us into our September. So we could say that the Haggai begins writing in September of 520 B.C. There wasn't a September back then, but it would be the equivalent of September 520 B.C. And that's very precise dating for these. He, in fact, gives you the exact day. So unlike some of the other prophets where I said, I think this is where he wrote, plus or minus 50 years, well, I think this is where he wrote, plus or minus no years. He just tells us exactly. Okay. He goes down and gives some introductory comments, but let's look at verse 2. Thus speaketh, now this is what Haggai has received from the Lord. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say the time is not come. Now that phrase, time is not come, is very significant, because I believe that refers to the 70 years of captivity. The Jews, when they were in Babylon, had figured out that they were going to be there for 70 years. Daniel, in chapter 9, plainly says, I've read Jeremiah, and Jeremiah says we're going to be in captivity for 70 years. Now, they didn't know exactly when they were going to come out of captivity, because they didn't know exactly when to start counting the 70 years. But Daniel had figured out through reading Jeremiah, as according to Daniel chapter 9, that they were going to be there for 70 years. So they knew that at 70 years, I believe they knew that's when the temple would be rebuilt. So here Haggai is saying, the people are saying the time has not come, or in other words, it's not the 70 years aren't ended yet, so we don't need to worry yet about building the temple. And Haggai is going to tell them through what the Lord has told him that his house should be built. But let's read a little bit further, starting in the middle of verse 2. The time is not come, or the end of the 70 years is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. They knew that they were to rebuild the house and that it was to, according to the prophecy of Jeremiah, to be done at the end of the 70 years. Then came the word, verse 3, of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie in waste?" Now what he's chastising them for is they had come back, and in this interim of 16 years, they had built themselves houses, and the word sealed there, C-I-E-L-E-D in the King James means paneled, I guess would be kind of what we're talking about. These were finished houses. These weren't shanties. These were fairly elaborate homes. And he said, you've got fairly elaborate paneled homes. And should the Lord's house lie in waste? Now, therefore, verse 5, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways, or you think about this. You have sown much. Now, verse 6 is going to say, you've worked real hard in some ways, but you haven't prospered. And he says, you have sown much, but you bring in little. You eat, but you don't get enough. You drink, but you're not filled. You clothe yourselves, but you're not warm. He that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Now, that phrase, putting money into a bag with holes, always in the Bible speaks of inflation. We use the phrase, the money burns a hole in someone's pocket. But inflation literally does that. You put the money in the bag, and with it rampant inflation, when you take it back out, there's not as much as there was when you put it in there from a purchasing power standpoint. So Haggai, the Lord is telling the people, you're planting, you're eating, you're drinking, you're clothing, you're earning money, but you're not getting ahead, are you? In other words, their material blessings were suffering because they had neglected the spiritual. That's what I believe Haggai is trying to tell these people. And inferred there is, until you start focusing on the spiritual, the physical's not going to get any better. Verse 7, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains, bring wood, and build the house. Not houses, but the house. And I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. So they're admonished to get about the task of building the temple while it had laid desolate. And they had been ordered to stop work on it for a period of time also, but now they have an opportunity to get back. If you drop down to verse 14, and the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadakah, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts in the 24th day of the sixth month. So 24 days after Haggai brings this admonition to them, it says they get busy and start building. Now you might wonder, if the Lord comes to someone and says, I want you to build my house, why would you wait 24 days to get started? Well, there's no rebuke in here for them waiting 24 days, and I think a probable explanation is this was the harvest time, so they may well have had to get their crops in, and the Lord may have made an allowance for that. It doesn't say that, but there's no rebuke for this 3.5-week delay, so I suspect maybe it had something to do with that. Then chapter 2, the seventh month, we're now into October of 520 B.C., and we find a series of questions being asked, and I want to at least touch on a couple of these because they're rather paradoxical. If you look in verse 3, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? In other words, the people are being asked, who's alive that saw the original temple? That's this house, the temple. Okay? And how do you see it now? In other words, he's asking those people, how does this temple you just built look to you compared to the original temple that Solomon built? And they were different. And he's going to say, In the last part of verse 3, is it not in your eyes in comparison as of nothing? In other words, he's saying this new temple you just built, if you remember the Solomon's temple, this new temple is pretty sad, isn't it? Now, the temple that Zerubbabel built was bigger than the temple that Solomon had built, but it wasn't nearly as grand, and it wasn't nearly as ornate. So that's what he's referring to. The new temple was of a larger size, but it wasn't nearly as grand, nor was it nearly as innate. But now, I'd like for you to drop down to verse 9, because we have what seems to be a contradiction here, and at a minimum, it's a paradox. The glory of this latter house, or this new temple, shall be greater than the former. Now, in verse 3, he said, this one you just built, sad compared to the first one. But in verse 9, he says, the glory of the one you just built will be greater than the one that Solomon built. Now, how can we reconcile that? How can it be sad in comparison to the first one, but yet have greater glory? Well, I believe the answer is found when you remember that the temple that they built here in a remodeled form by Herod was the temple that Jesus Christ set foot in. And any place that Jesus Christ sets his feet upon has more glory than any place that he doesn't. And I believe that's why he says it shall be greater than the former, because the Son of God will visit in the incarnate body this temple. And I think that's a lesson for you and I to take to heart. You, if you have Jesus Christ dwelling in you, are more glorious than you can ever be any other way. And no matter how we look, how we feel, what besets us in the eyes of the Lord, when you've got Jesus in you, you're more glorious than anybody who doesn't. And I think that's the message here from the temple. I just think that's an interesting paradox. And that's my spin on it anyway, or that's my understanding of it. Tom? Okay, in verse 6, once more, you lost me.
Yes, in verse 6, when he speaks of once more.
Yet once?
Of a future event. You've built this one, but now once more I'll build one. I will build a temple. I'll shake up the nations. And I thought of that as a prophecy of the church down in verse 6 through 9.
Okay, I see where you're getting that. I've not taken it that way, but it would certainly be true of the church. It would certainly be true of the church. But this latter house, I take that back to his conversation in verse 6 of this house and the previous house. It could be, or one of us may be wrong. But either way, the principle of where Jesus abides is more glorious. And Jesus abides in the church, and Jesus abode in the temple. Okay. I've always taken this to be referring to the temple. Okay, any comments, questions? I'm glad you brought that out, Tom. It gives us all a little more fodder to chew on. Okay. Another thing that I want to point out to you here in verse 2, and I'll have to move on through Haggai, is there's a contrast beginning with verse 11 and following with holiness and sin. Okay? And if you look in verse 12, he says, if one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest said no. In other words, he's saying, if you have something that's holy and you touch it, does that make you holy? And the answer is no. But now look at verse 13. He says, if you have something that's unclean by a dead body and you touch it, shall you become unclean? And the answer is yes. Now we're contrasting sin and holiness. And the application there is that sin is communicable. It's transferable by being around it. But holiness is not transferable by being around it. Holiness is obtainable by your relationship with God. So in other words, if I associate with sinners, there's a high likelihood that I'm going to eventually have their modus operandi or sin transferred to me. But just because I sit in the pews and I'm surrounded by holy people, that's not going to make me holy. What's going to make me holy is my relationship. And I think it's important for us to understand what he's saying here. Sin is communicable. That's why it's often described as leaven, which infests the whole lump. Holiness is not communicable. Holiness, you go back to the original giver of it and you get your own slice of pie, so to speak. Okay? For instance, the Lord's Supper is holy. But you're not made holy because you partake of the Lord's Supper. You partake of the Lord's Supper because you're first holy. That's a big difference. Partaking of communion doesn't make you holy. You partake of communion because you're holy. And you become holy not by partaking of the communion, but by accepting Jesus Christ and being washed in his blood. And I know we all agree, we all know that, but it's so wonderful to see these Old Testament people make such deep doctrinal applications when sometimes we think they're just in historical oblivion. Okay, any questions on Haggai before we look a little bit at Zechariah? Anne?
You might say sin is contagious.
Absolutely, that's what I mean when I say communicable. Contagious is even a more graphic word. It is. Yeah, you can catch sin by being around it. You catch holiness by being around God only. Only.
I like his repeated statement as he tells the people, consider your ways, what you've done in Gethsemane.
Yes.
A couple times, verse 5 and verse 7, maybe, and this thought continues, well, this thing about sin, consider your ways. That's the lesson.
Stop and think. I used to have a boss that told me, I'd like to go by your desk every once in a while and see your feet propped up on it. Because hopefully that means you're thinking. Occasionally. He didn't want to see it too often. But consider your ways. Stop and think. Don't just be a whirlwind of activity. Okay, Zechariah. Zechariah was began writing about 2 months after Haggai. So I would be just unbelievably shocked if these two gentlemen didn't know each other. He tells us that in the eighth month, and you remember Haggai was in the sixth month, in the same year of Darius came the word, and he began to speak. And again, the basic message is going to be very similar, although probably the book of Zechariah, in my opinion, is definitely the singular most difficult book in the Old Testament to understand. And I say it's that because it may not be any harder than Daniel, but we spent less time on it than we have Daniel. And it rivals Revelation, so we weren't going to be able to go into all the ins and outs. But let me give you a view of it. It's the longest of the minor prophets, and it's virtually identical to Daniel in length. If you ever have trouble in the Bible of keeping track of all the Zecharias, welcome to the ship, because there are at least 27 different Zecharias in the Bible. 16 of them appear in 1st and 2nd Chronicles alone. And if you go through there, it is a real chore, almost impossible to totally keep them sorted out. But this was Zechariah who wrote in 520 B.C., and he was writing to the children of Israel, and again exhorting them to get the temple built. The outline for this book is that through chapters 1 through 6, Zechariah has 8 visions. And all of these visions have a message, but they're all tied to encouraging them to go ahead and build the temple. And then in chapters 9 through the end of the book, chapter 14, there is a series of prophetic statements, many of them centering around Jesus Christ as the Messiah. Probably, except for Isaiah, Zechariah is the most messianic book in the Old Testament. The first vision that he has occurs beginning with chapter 1, verse 7, and it simply is telling him there is going to be peace. The earth is going to be at rest, so you're going to have time to get the temple built. The second one begins in chapter 1, verse 18, and it talks about the powers that have come up against it. I believe the four horns there refer to Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. But it's certainly talking about the powers that are going to come up against them or have come up against them, and it says they are going to be punished. Even though time is short, I want to comment on chapter 2. There's a couple of verses that we get phrases that we use a lot. Verse 8 is the phrase, apple of his eye, and you've heard that over and over. Verse 12 may be the most interesting. The Lord shall inherit Judah his portion in the Holy Land. And we use that phrase, Holy Land, a lot. To my knowledge, this is the only verse in the Bible that the phrase Holy Land occurs. Okay. And maybe that's a bit of trivia, but I don't know that it's simply trivia. Because God places a higher premium on spiritual affinity than he does geographical proximity, especially today. And while it's wonderful when some of us have a chance to go back and see the Holy Land and see some places where we know Jesus walked, I am fully persuaded, on the other side of that coin, God is just as interested in Des Moines, Iowa, as he is Jerusalem in this day and age. Every soul is equally precious. And again, that's not to trivialize the inspirational part of seeing some of these, because I know that's there. I've talked to too many of you. But the Holy Land is wherever God is. Remember Moses at the burning bush? He said, take off your shoes because you're standing on holy ground. Well, he wasn't in Israel when he said that. He was where God was. But that's the only verse that I know of in the Bible that talks about the Holy Land, uses that phrase, I guess I should say. The fourth vision, it starts with chapter 3, and it's talking about how we're going to exchange our filthy rags and be given robes of righteousness. The fifth vision I want to make a comment on, it's in chapter 4, and it's talking about, let me read verse 2. And said unto me, what seest thou? And I said, I have looked, and behold, a candlestick, all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it. Now, remember the other night I said there weren't candlesticks back then. And sometimes you have to understand we're talking about a lamp and not a candlestick. And if you think candlestick, you'll miss the meaning. Well, if you think candlestick here in chapter 4, you're going to miss the meaning. Because he's talking about a lamp, which was some kind of a little vessel in which they poured oil. So we've got two elements here. We've got the lamp and we've got olive oil that was burnt. And the lamp symbolizes the Word of God, and the oil in the lamp symbolizes the Holy Spirit. And he's saying it's through the Word of God that God's Spirit is going to illuminate truth. And that's a very important concept here for the people to understand. We go down through vision 6, which talks about the land being purified of wickedness. Vision 7, also in chapter 5, their sins are going to be carried away. Chapter 8, four chariots. And chapter 6, verses 1 through 8 corresponds almost identically to Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. And it talks about how God is constantly going to be vigilantly protecting his people. Chapter 11, if you studied the wise shepherd and the foolish shepherd, there's that famous parable about contrasting the wise shepherd and the foolish shepherds. And I'm sure the Jews had this chapter in mind when Jesus in John chapter 10 said, I am the good shepherd, because they knew their Old Testament very well. Chapter 12 talks about Jerusalem going to be saved, and it even has a messianic passage in there about the crucifixion. I can't go through this book and not point out a few of these messianic. Chapter 9, verse 9. Let me point you to that one. These are just wonderful. I hope you take time to go back and see how explicitly the ministry and the coming of Jesus Christ was foretold 5 centuries or 5.5 centuries here before it happened. In chapter 9, verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold thy king, and that's Christ, cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation lowly, and riding upon an ass and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. And you remember Jesus when he went in on Palm Sunday, a week before he arose from the grave, he went in on an ass, and they into Jerusalem. This is exactly what he's talking about here. You can find that in Matthew 21, but all the Gospels, I believe. John 12, I think, has it. And I think Mark and Luke also have it. And I'll just have to kind of pick and choose here. It must have been earlier. There's one in here about... Well, let's look at chapter 6, verse 12 and 13. That's the ones I wanted. In chapter 6, verse 12, it talks about, "Behold, the man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord." And that's talking about Christ. Okay, and the temple there that he's talking about definitely is the church. Okay. Then there's an interesting thing in verse 13, if you'll bear with me, and I know I'm reading a little fast. "Even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne." Rule upon his throne is what a king does, and he shall be a priest. Jesus brought the kingship of Israel and the priesthood back into one man. He alone is king and priest. All other priests were not kings. All other kings were not priests. And when Saul, as a king, tried to act like a priest, he got into all kinds of trouble. It just couldn't be done. But Jesus reunited both of those. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful passage there. Anybody have a particular passage you want to allude to, direct us to, or a question? I'll just pick and choose. 11, 12, and 13. Okay. Chapter 11, verse 12 and 13. And I believe this is the Lord or Christ, "said unto them, If ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. For they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver," which was the price of a slave, but you remember Jesus was sold. Now, I think that verse also proves the eternal nature of Jesus, because that's Jesus talking there, I believe, because he said, "my price." And Jesus was in heaven at this time. He wasn't incarnate on the earth, but we know he was in heaven all the way from Genesis 1, because it said, "let us." Then verse 13, "And the Lord said unto me, Cast it out unto the potter, a goodly price that I was priced at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter of the house of the Lord." Okay. And many times you're going to see dual prophecies here, but this one really hits home when you think about the 30 pieces. So here in Zechariah, we've seen the 30 pieces of silver. We've seen he's going to be the branch. We've seen the prophecies that bespeak of what Jesus is going to do. Micah had him being born in Bethlehem. Daniel tells us the year. And all these things are going to come to a grand and glorious conclusion. Anybody else have a question or a passage on Zechariah that you're particularly interested in or would like to bring to our attention?
Romans 12:10, they look upon me when they pierce.
Right.
Chapter 13, verse 6, the wounds in his hands, wounded in the house of his friends.
It's just from chapter 9 through chapter 14, it's just drenched with messianic prophecy. It may be the most consolidated grouping of messianic prophecy we have. Isaiah is a lot longer book, and Psalms is a lot longer book, but 17 of the Psalms directly are prophetic of the Messiah. Psalms 22 is almost totally that. Totally that. Okay. But Zechariah's real initial thrust is to get the people building the temple, and then the last six chapters of Zechariah have a lot to do with prophesying the coming of the Son of God. Okay, let's look at Malachi for a few minutes, and then we'll see if we've got some time to wrap everything up. Malachi is going to be writing approximately 100 years after Haggai and Zechariah. We don't know exactly when he wrote, but probably somewhere between 425 and 400 B.C. We know that all of the Old Testament was written prior to 280 BC, because that's when the Septuagint, or the Greek translation of the Old Testament, was written down in Alexandria, Egypt. But almost all of the historical writings and the scribes say that Malachi was the last writer of the Old Testament, and he was probably around 400 BC. So we're now going to go in a four-century period of silence between the end of Malachi and the coming of John the Baptist and Jesus. Malachi chapter 1, verse 1 is the only mention of Malachi by name that we have in the Bible. And Malachi simply means messenger, and that's exactly what he was. And he seems to kind of deal with a series of questions, almost in a dialectic matter of saying, this is what's been said, but you say. He tries to show them their contradiction. For instance, in chapter 1, verse 6, the son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear, saith the Lord of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name? And you say, wherein have we despised thy name? Malachi is saying, you despise the Lord, and then, but he says, but you look at me and say, when did we ever do that? It's just like little children. The parent says, you did that. And they'll say, who, me? That's exactly what these people were doing. If you look down in chapter 2, verse 10, have we not all one Father? Hath not one Father created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother? And then you drop down to 14 after he tells them what they're saying, but he says, but you say, wherefore? Or who, us? There's none as guilty as those who play innocent very hard. And that's exactly what this does. In chapter 3, verse 8, that famous passage about robbing God. Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, when have we robbed you? He says point blank, you've robbed God. But you keep saying, well, when did we do that? Prove that. It's just such an immaturish thing that it strikes home. It's just us today all over. There's just no one as guilty as the man who pleads his innocence that verifiously. He talks about the sins. He talks about adultery and divorce. Chapter 2, verse 16. I've got to mention that. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away or divorce. If you ever have any question or ever have any difficulty explaining to someone God's position on divorce, write down Malachi chapter 2, verse 16 in capital letters, underline it, circle it with red, blue, yellow, orange, and neon. God hates it. All ways, shapes, and form. He hateth putting away. For one covereth violence with his garments, and the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed of your spirit, that ye deal not treacherously. Now, I was very firm on what I believe God thinks about divorce. I do understand and I do believe in the New Testament that God does allow those who have mates who are sexually unfaithful the opportunity to. But even if one chooses that, and even if God allows that, I still believe he hates it, because it's a ripping apart of what he has joined together. And when you rip it apart, you never rip it apart at the seam. You always rip it apart at the joints. And everybody suffers, usually. Okay. I'll get off my soapbox on that. Chapter 3, verse 1, we've got a shadow of John the Baptist, and we've got a shadow of Christ. Behold, verse 1, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom ye seek. Okay, the messenger who shall prepare the way before me, that's a shadow of John the Baptist, and the Lord whom ye seek, that's a shadow of Christ. So in that one verse, we're told that these two are coming, and they're going to be linked together. Okay, I want to spend a little time on chapter 4, and then we'll go back and consider anything that you would like in addition to this. Chapter 4 is only 6 verses, so I want to read it thoroughly. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly, shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. Total annihilation. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. Now that Son of Righteousness is Jesus Christ, who is going to bring spiritual healing in his wings. So in verse 1, he's told us what's going to happen to everyone who disobeys God. But again, he immediately gives us a hope. And the hope is, if you fear the Son of Righteousness, you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. In other words, you'll be blessed and you'll grow. So you contrast verse 1 with verse 2, and you've got, in essence, the whole message of the Bible. You reject God, you're going to be annihilated. You accept his Son, and you're going to grow and nurture. Verse 3, and you shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be as ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, all the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet. Now we understand that Elijah the prophet referred to there is John the Baptist. The Jews don't believe that this Elijah was John the Baptist. In fact, many Jews at Passover still leave an empty chair at the Passover table. They're still waiting for Elijah to come back. Because until they see Elijah, they know the Messiah can't be here. That's their understanding of it. So when you misunderstand what he means by Elijah the prophet, then you're going to be off on your time sequence for when the Messiah came. We understand that this was a reference to John the Baptist. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to children and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Curse is the closing words for the Old Testament, because all the old law could do was tell man that he was under the curse of death. John, when he concludes his 22nd chapter of Revelations, ends with a blessing, because it's the plan of salvation that we have in the New Testament that changes the curse of the Old Testament into the blessing of salvation. John doesn't end the very last verse with the word blessing, but if you go back up a little bit, just a few verses, he says, blessed are ye that do my commandments. That's the passage we get that song that we sing in the red book out of. Okay. We've got 5 minutes, and I'm glad, because I want to give you a chance to ask not only questions on anything I've said tonight, but anything over the week. And then if I have any time left over, we'll kind of try to pull it together a little bit. We have covered a lot of material, and I know full well that we've covered material that you don't cover that frequently. Therefore, it's harder plowing, but it's hardest the first time, and that's what makes it easier the next time. So hopefully we've broken the crust of the ground in some areas, and for those of you that have studied it more frequently, maybe there's been, I know there has to have been new things we all get out of it every time we go over it. But these are wonderful, wonderful books that tell us what happens to people that disobey. They tell us we all have hope when we do obey, and they tell us about the Savior that was going to come. And then when you go into the New Testament, you just see them fulfilled line by line by line. Any comments or questions? Tom?
John, I suggest that people take note on Malachi 4:5 about Elijah. Take a reference over to Matthew chapter 17, verse 10 and 13. We know that prophecy was in regard to John the Baptist because Jesus said so.
Okay, very good. Very good. If you got any question, then that was Matthew 17?
10 through 13.
Okay, Matthew 17, 10 through 13. Very good. Very good. Usually, if you'll dig long enough, the Bible will explain itself.
Well,
Okay. Matthew 11:14, I think, is what Lowell said, and Tom referred to Matthew 17:10-13. Okay. After the close of the book of Malachi, God is silent for over 400 years. And the people just don't hear from him. But one of the things that the captivity did is it did cure them of idolatry, because after they came back from Babylon, they never were consumed with idolatry like they were. They had a lot of other problems, but that cured them of idolatry. Cured them of idolatry. Okay. After the close, or beginning with the close of Malachi, Israel was under six different countries up and through the time of Christ. They were under the Medo-Persians, the Grecians, the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Maccabeans, and then the Romans.